So we're going to be here today with a panelist that if you know a lot about Great Lakes, or if you don't know anything about Great Lakes issues, you're going to learn a lot. If you already know some things about Great Lakes issues and climate change, you're going to learn quite a bit anyways. As I sat and talked with these folks beforehand, they easily fall into some discussions that stretch my mind as a journalist, and hopefully it'll stretch yours as well. So just to let you know who we have here, and we're going to start with my immediate left. We have John Magnuson, who is Professor Emeritus of Zoology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So this is a home game for John. And he's also Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology here at the university, with two research stations, including one at Trout Lake, which I'll be visiting later in the week for the tour for IJNR. So I'm looking forward to that. John is also the co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impact, or WICCI, W-I-C-C-I. He is... has written a number of, obviously, scholarly articles and books, including one, Long-Term Dynamics of Lakes in Landscape, a book on inland lakes here in the North Country. And also, as he mentioned to me earlier, which I missed on his bio, he is a 1995 and 2001 contributor to the IPCC, particularly in adaptation of aquatic marine, aquatic freshwater and marine environments, and much more, as I mentioned. His focus, as it mentions on his biography, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, each of the speakers here, since I'm just getting to know you as well, but his focus is on long-term ecological research on lake systems, potential influence of climate change on inland waters, fish and fisheries ecology, biogeography, and a number of other things, landscape ecology of lake and stream systems, and so on. So there's a lot to learn from John, so it's good to have him here. To his left, Brent Lofgren from the physical scientist with NOAA, Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, correct, in Ann Arbor with a new building there. Right?
Yeah, new building.
New building. So, and a new director, right.
Everything's new.
His research focuses on modeling atmospheric systems and their coupling to terrestrial water surfaces with a particular emphasis, and correct me if I'm wrong again, interdecadal timescales in the Great Lakes Basin. So, and much more. And as I, if the bios get shorter, it's because I'm looking at my notes and realize you don't want to hear from me reading their bios. You can read that later. So I, if they get shorter as I go on, that's why. And to his left, we have Jim Bruce, who is co-chair of the Public Interest Advisory Group for the International Upper Great Lakes Study. In 1967, he was the first director of the Canada Center for Inland Waters and later director general of the Inland Waters Directorate Canada. He's co-chair of the Great Lakes Water Quality Board of the IJC, the International Joint Commission between Canada and the United States. It was, right? Thank you. And acting Deputy Secretary General of the World Meteorological Association. And to his left, we have Emily Green, who is the Great Lakes Program Director for the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club, as you know, is the nation's oldest and largest grassroots organization, 1.5 million members, according to what I read online. And recently, just this morning, I read her testimony, 2008, on the Great Lakes Legacy Act, where she gave some convincing testimony. We're going to talk to each of them about these issues. I mentioned that John, to my left here, is the home team. So as his right is home team, he can kick off or receive. And also, being from Ohio, as I am, John being from Wisconsin, I've already talked about the Ohio State-Wisconsin game, which is later this afternoon. I haven't made plans to watch it together yet, but we're both interested. So anyways, we're going to let John start as the home team and just kind of talk about an overview of what we're looking at here today.
Well, first, welcome to Wisconsin.
Let's bring the mic close to you.
Welcome, Wisconsin. I actually see a few Wisconsinites out there, but for the rest of you, welcome. I'm going to lead into the idea of adaptation, largely, of adaptation of human beings to the changes that are occurring around us. And I'll start off by talking about why climate change is such a challenging kind of an issue. All of us know what to do when a thunderstorm comes up, things that happen quickly. We know how to adjust to seasonal changes. We know when to put the boat in. We know when to get the winter coat out. But as you move into areas that are more like land use change, cultural eutrophication, or over-enrichment of lakes, if you like, and especially climate change, the time period over which things are occurring is very slow and very, very long. And in contrast to getting out of the rain, the negative effects are largely those that will be felt by the next generations. So it's more difficult for us to deal with scientifically because it's slow and climate has that variable weather in it all the time. And it's very difficult for us to deal with socially and politically because, in fact, those who are impacted the most are young or not born yet. The two major challenges of climate change, I think, are well known to us. And one of them is mitigation, which and the other one is adaptation. I presume that you all know those two words in the context of climate change. If not, I better define them quickly. I don't see so many nods. Yeah. Everybody's got that. Okay.
Good enough.
Well, that's great. But I don't think what we have on the table is just how significant the adaptation part might be. It. If you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and look at their scenarios out to the end of the century, they have different assumptions that they make about the way we will behave, humans will behave. And one of the scenarios they have is what we call the business as usual scenario. We basically don't change our energy policies. The U.S., China, Europe, and India never negotiate. Countries don't take action and so forth. And on the other end of it, they have what is called what they think we might achieve if we really had our heads to the or our shoulders to the yoke, if you like. And that would be on the international political area. Agreements are made between the U.S. and the other major greenhouse gas emitters that, in fact, we do make significant social, political, and technological movements away from a carbon economy, that population growth rate is not as high as it might have been. And the interesting thing to me is if you look at the temperatures at the end of the century, and, of course, these are not the accurate ones. These are just estimates of the end of the century. The business-as-usual scenario for a global temperature is an increase of 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit, 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit. The best case that these people can think of at the present time, which we may not be able to achieve, is 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. Now, the role of mitigation, the political role, the technological role, the understanding the way the system works, the hope is that by the end of the century we don't go to 7.2, but we go to maybe something closer to 3.2. That leaves the 3.2 in the hands of ecologists, city planners, and things of that nature that deal with the adaptation side. If the global temperature is 3.2 degrees warmer by the end of the century, is that safe enough? For example, what's that mean to sea level rise, and what's it mean to Great Lakes water levels? What does it mean to many of the things and flooding and all of these things? Is 3.2 safe enough? And the role of adaptation is to arm us as best as we can to be able to have a sustainable future in a world that's 3.2 degrees warmer. Okay? So, interestingly enough, the amount of temperature increase that these very general models have forward at the end of the century, the 3.2 degrees for adaptation, and then the mitigation, which is about a 4-degree drop. What I wish to make before I begin to pass it on to the rest of the group is the adaptation side is equally important to the mitigation side. Early efforts, engineering efforts, political efforts, negotiational efforts have all been on the mitigation side, and it's well worth the R. But even if they achieve their most hopeful future, the rest of us are going to be living in a world where we're going to depend on ourselves and colleagues to provide adaptation strategies to do as best as we can in a sustainable future at a world that's considerably different climatologically than today. And I'll stop there and come back later.
And a reminder, you may have said this at the beginning as I was taking a note, this handout is on the chairs in the back and also in the front here, and this is what John was referring to on his first couple of slides. So you may want to grab that to refresh your mind about what he just talked about, but also as the discussion continues. And as we take it over to Brett, as I mentioned, Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, John has sort of given us the adaptation mitigation view from 35,000 feet, and we're going to bring it down a little bit, I think, as Brent talks about, tell us about Great Lakes Environmental Research and what we need to know here.
Okay, I wanted to fill you in on a little bit of what's going on with predictions of lake levels, and unfortunately some of the most exciting things have not passed peer review yet, but things are changing within the community as far as our understanding of what might happen with lake levels in the Great Lakes as a result of climate change. I guess I wanted to step back first, though, to sort of more the global understanding of climate change due to greenhouse gases. I think in various venues within this conference, you've heard from people who are saying that there's a strong scientific consensus, and I'm here to affirm that there is a strong scientific consensus within the global community that greenhouse gases are causing an increase in temperatures. And I consider myself part of that consensus. As you go down to smaller spatial scales, get more regionally specific, the consensus is not quite as strong as far as some of the impacts. And there are a few different reasons for that. One is more strictly scientific, in that individual regions, more specific spatial scales, will have more noise in what's going on. Greater amounts of natural variability are occurring in variables such as temperature, precipitation, water levels, and so on. Another reason is simply that when you're looking at a particular region, the number of scientists that are there to study it is less than the number who are concentrating on the global science of this. So in the case of the global concern, from the modeling side, there are many modeling centers distributed throughout the world that do the modeling of the global climate. And for instance, the IPCC report of 2007 took input from a large number of different modeling centers. I don't know the exact number, but all right, Jim says 22.
That's good enough for me.
I'll take that, and that's a big number. And essentially, all of these agree on an increase in temperature over the next century. They don't precisely agree on the quantity. But then when you're looking at a question such as the result in terms of Great Lakes levels, most of the, actually I should say, when you're looking specifically at scientific articles that give you the, as an output, the Great Lakes levels specifically, there's only one model that has been used to produce those. And there's some question about it. And as I told you, my own work has yet to pass peer review. But there are some other approaches that have been taken by others. There was a paper by Manabi et al. And Milley et al., a couple of papers from 2003 that showed increases in discharge from the St. Lawrence River. So this doesn't directly say lake levels, but it very directly implies that. And also more recently from here at UW-Madison, there was a paper by Kutzbach et al., and this has it couched in even more obscure terms. It shows an increase in water vapor flux convergence over the Great Lakes region. And to those of us who are scientists, that means the lake levels are going to go up. But, you know, it's something that needs some translation. So, you know, there are a few different viewpoints out there on this point. Actually, one of the things I was meaning to say sort of at the beginning of my remarks was I'm going to thank Peter Annan for a conversation I had with him yesterday to sort of refocus what I was going to present. So in any case, I guess I'll sum it up by saying that when we look at some of these more regional effects and specific impacts of climate change, some of the scientific questions really are still open.
Okay, thanks very much, Brent. And we're going to go to Jim from the international side and bring the mic close to you so everybody can hear, and we'll see how that goes. Is the international science community convinced, or where do we stand with that? Tell me what you want to say.
Oh, yes, the International Science Committee is convinced.
Can everybody hear okay? No, Jim, would you bring a little close? Just slide the stand closer to you.
And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change...
Tilt it towards you. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Sorry, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change certainly expresses...
let me see if that's on.
It may not be on.
There we go. We have amplification.
The IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change really expresses that international consensus. Brent has talked about the problems with global and regional climate models, and of course they're one way of looking to the future. But I'd like to suggest that there's another way that might be very applicable to the Great Lakes that we can think about it. And that is to examine what has happened since about 1970, which you will see in this nice volume prepared by NOAA and other agencies on global climate change impacts in the United States. 1970 was about the time greenhouse gases became the dominant external forcing factor on the world's climate system. So if we look at what's happened in the Great Lakes and into the climate around the Great Lakes since then, I think since greenhouse gases are going to dominate the climate in coming decades, we have a pretty good indication of at least the direction in which things are likely to move in coming decades. And what I can say is that climate change is already affecting both lake levels and Great Lakes water quality. First of all, we've seen changes in the seasonality of the annual cycle of lake levels. Earlier spring breakup of the tributary rivers in recent decades results in a shifting to earlier in the season of the spring high levels of most of the lakes and the fall or winter low levels. Calculations of what are called net basin supply, that is precipitation falling on the lakes, runoff into the lakes, and evaporation from the lakes, has shown that since the 70s, winters and springs have been wetter, summers drier than the long-term averages. So on the question of long-term lake levels, we have, as Brent has already suggested, rather conflicting signals. First of all, we've seen that ice cover in the lakes has declined over the years. In fact, there's in this volume I held up a second ago, there's a nice graph that shows the trend in the maximum percentage cover of ice in the Great Lakes, and it's declined from something like an average of 70 days to an average of 40 days since 1970. And this results in more of the sun's energy being absorbed by the water rather than reflected by the ice in the wintertime. And this has resulted in turn in observed faster increases in water temperatures in the lakes than in the air temperatures, according to Jay Austin and his colleagues up in Duluth. So the highest surface water temperature results in more evaporation and more lake effect snowfall. Both, and the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab of Brent's colleagues has determined a distinct trend towards increased evaporation since the late 60s. So there's the one side, increased evaporation, lower levels. But offsetting that, there has been observed an increase in flow of moist air from the Gulf of Mexico, which models suggest is related to greenhouse forcing of the climate, and that's dumping more precipitation in the northern Great Plains. We've seen quite a lot of floods on the Red River and so on. And it's also dumping more precipitation in the spring in the southern part of Lake Superior and Lake Michigan basins. So the question of how these two factors are going to play out in the long term is something that I think is still somewhat uncertain. And there's a major binational study underway, the International Upper Great Lakes Study, which I'm working with, under the International Joint Commission, which is supposed to report out in about 2012. The earlier climate projections, which are also in this book I mentioned, suggest that anywhere from little change to will occur to falls of 1.5 meter or more, or 5 feet or so of the lakes. Now, if those projections, the 5 feet projections, or anything close to them, are borne out by this international study, we will be proposing an adaptive management strategy to deal with the situation. But I'd like to emphasize more the water quality side. There are two main climate change factors that are important in affecting water quality and have already affected water quality. First of all, the increasing air and water temperatures, and secondly, the increasing frequency of high-intensity rains. The rising water temperatures, of course, result in more rapid growth of cladophora, blue-green algae, and other nuisance and toxic algae. In addition, longer periods of summer-like conditions result in longer stratification of lake waters, with the warm surface layer divided from the cold bottom waters. This longer isolation of the bottom waters results in earlier depletion of oxygen in these waters. And this is the zone which John will tell you is loved by some fish species, and loss of oxygen results in dead zones near the bottom before the cooling in autumn allows greater mixing of the water again. This lack of oxygen results in release of nutrients, contaminants like mercury from the bottom sediments into the biota and the water. Since 2000, we have seen in several years a return to the anoxia of the 60s in Lake Erie Central Basin. And that's rather sad because we'd done a good job of cleaning it up in the 60s and the 70s. In the 70s and 80s. Four of the Great Lakes have experienced stratification period increases of up to 6 days per decade. Major fish kills have resulted in Lakes Michigan in 2001 and Erie in 2002. So these unfortunate trends towards eutrophication will be accelerated in the warming climate. And to compound the problem, runoff of phosphorus, nutrients, and contaminants from croplands, animal feedlots, city streets is increasing as the frequency of high-intensity rains and flash floods rises. As the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor, and we even have a good equation that describes that, which shows in theory a 7% increase in precipitable water occurs with each degree C increase in warming of the atmosphere. Now, this doesn't affect very much, well, it affects little, the total precipitation, but it affects much more the intensity of rain when the atmosphere is geared up to produce rainfall. This recent NOAA report shows that an increase of 31% in the Great Lakes Basin in the since 1958 in the amount of rain that falls in very heavy rain events. That is the highest 1%. This increases erosion from cropland, washing of nutrients, and contaminants. Continuous measurements of phosphorus discharges to Western Lake Erie from mainly agricultural watersheds have shown that almost all of the phosphorus loading occurs in these heavy rain, high flow episodes, now on the increase. And many cities in the basin have increasingly found storm runoff overtaxing storm sewer systems, resulting in overflow into sanitary sewers with sewage waste discharged directly into the lakes. Now, all the research that's been done with all the models suggests that we're going to see a continued trend towards increasing frequency of very heavy rain events in a greenhouse forest climate. So these two factors, the warming of the waters and the greater frequency of intense rain events, will be major challenges to enhancing or even maintaining Great Lakes water quality. At the stock-taking meeting of the IJC earlier this week, which I attended in Windsor, it was reported that nearshore regions throughout the lakes, except for Lake Superior, are deteriorating again after the very successful cleanup of the 70s and 80s. The International Joint Commission's Great Lakes Water Quality Board has indicated that climate change will be a major impediment to achieving and sustaining the water quality objectives agreed to by USA and Canada. We're going to have to redouble our efforts at controlling erosion and runoff from agricultural lands and from urban areas.
Jim, can we pick up a few more points after that? I want to get to Emily, and then we'll move into a few more points. Apologize. You can see as we've run down the line here, as John has talked about adaptation and mitigation, and Brent talking about the open questions on natural variability with the consensus on climate change, that there's much to discuss. And as Jim just laid out a laundry list of things that the Great Lakes are suffering under already or as things struggle, we come to the question that Emily, I want to kind of start with Emily to talk about this. And this goes for the journalists as well. Okay, what do we do about this, or what can be done about this at all? I mean, that's where adaptation and mitigation both address that, but now specifically from the Sierra Club's point of view and the public's point of view, what can we do about this? Tell us about that.
Sure. Thanks. I'm just going to highlight sort of three things. I mean, I don't have a lot of time, so I want to just flag three things. It's certainly not the extent of things we ought to do about climate change, but I think there are three things that are specific to the Great Lakes that would help us a lot here. I mean, as you've heard, climate change is happening. It's going to have some significant impacts on the region, on the region's ecosystem, and on its communities. So two things I'm going to touch on have to do with adaptation. The first is we need to increase the resiliency of the ecosystem as a whole, and I think many of you are familiar with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. I think there was a panel on it yesterday. The whole point of that initiative is to take actions that will help address, you know, problems like polluted runoff, habitat destruction, erosion, and increase the overall resiliency of the ecosystem so it's better able to adjust to the challenges and threats posed by climate change. So that's what I would call a no-regrets action. We should do it anyway. We should do it for good reason now, but it will help us deal with the impacts of climate change. The second thing I want to just touch on briefly has to do with what communities are facing, and specifically the flooding and increased pollution that Jim mentioned as a result of the severe rain events. I think, as probably many of you know, communities like Milwaukee, stormwater and sewage all flow into the same sewage system. So stormwater is treated by the sewage treatment plants. Huge problem if you have big storm events because particularly in developed areas where rain flows quickly over roofs and pavements into the sewer, too much water entering that sewage treatment system too quickly overwhelms it. It simply can't be treated fast enough. So when it's overwhelmed, the only option is to either dump it straight into the lake, which means you're dumping raw sewage, or to allow it to back up to people's basements, equally unpopular. I think big cities like Chicago and Milwaukee have constructed these very expensive deep tunnel systems to try to hold that, you know, storm water so they can treat it later. And those have helped. In Milwaukee, they decreased the overflows from 8.5 billion gallons a year before the deep tunnel to 450 million gallons a year after the deep tunnel. They have like roughly two overflows a year. But many people would say, well, you know, any overflows are too many. That's still an awful lot of raw untreated sewage going into Lake Michigan. So, and that, again, you know, the deep tunnel system, the only way to expand it is to build more deep tunnels. So as you get more and more of these severe rain events with climate change, that problem's just going to get worse. And in communities like Madison, where the stormwater flows into a separate system, so it doesn't go into the sewage treatment plant, it still can be overwhelmed if the rain comes too fast. There's simply too much water, you know, that can fit through the pipes. So the result is flooding in the right near my house. Downhill from it, the houses all flood during the heaviest rains. So what do we do? One thing that we want to flag is sort of starting to use natural systems that are more effective at capturing rainwater and absorbing it and slowing it down, basically keeping the rain from reaching the sewage treatment plants or sewer system to begin with. And at the same time, these systems, which are collectively known as green infrastructure and low-impact development, improve water quality, improve the quality of life in communities. And we think, these are things like putting natural areas along waterways, putting soil and plantings on flat roofs to absorb rain, putting in rain barrels and rain gardens. I mean, this is not really complicated stuff, but it's found that it's really effective. For example, communities along the Rouge River in Michigan put in natural plantings along the river. They call them grow zones. And a recent assessment of the project found that the Nankin Mills grow zone in Hines Park, Michigan, provides 9.9 million cubic feet of stormwater storage for 2.25-inch rain. That's equivalent in cost to a typical stormwater retention system of that would be almost $20 million. So, and in Grays Lake, Illinois, they just built a new subdivision where they incorporated like rain gardens, swales, that kind of thing, permeable pavements. Resulted in a cost savings of 15% compared to traditional techniques and incredibly much more effective at just reducing the runoff out of that community. So, you know, the thing is that you talk to city managers about this stuff and they're like, well, you know, or city engineers, what's green infrastructure? You know, what is that? What does it do? So there's a basic education that needs to happen. We could require a percentage of federal clean water funds to actually go towards these techniques. We could require green infrastructure to be part of sewage treatment plant permitting. But the bottom line is we need to do more of this because particularly in urban areas, it's going to be key to helping us adapt to climate change. The third thing I just want to mention, and hopefully we can discuss all of this, has to do with mitigation, and this is an opportunity specific to the Great Lakes. One of the major things we have to do in climate change, particularly in this region, is get ourselves off coal. We get about 75% of our electricity from coal in the region. And in order to do this, we need to do, you know, a lot of different things, but we need a bigger source of renewable energy. And in this region, we have an opportunity that's unique to the Great Lakes in offshore wind. And this is something that hasn't been talked about a ton, but starting to be talked about more. There's good wind out in the Great Lakes. They consider it class 5 and 6, which is equal to or better than the wind that's in the Dakotas and the Great Plains out over the lakes. In terms of capacity, depending on whose estimate you're looking at, they say there's 123 to 249 gigawatts of wind available out on the Great Lakes in relatively shallow waters. That's a lot of wind. I mean, that in terms of meeting our needs. The other really interesting thing about it is it's very near to load centers. So you have cities, Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee. You could put offshore wind and not have to transport it very far, which is a major, a major benefit over bringing it in from the plains. And in our view, you can do it responsibly and site these things in a way that is not going to be completely damaging to the Great Lakes ecosystem. It doesn't mean windmills all over the lakes. For example, if you put an 1,800 megawatt installation, which is big, it's at least as big as a large new coal plant, that would be enough to meet 10% of Wisconsin's future energy needs. That would require a 10 by 10 mile area in Lake Michigan, or 0.5% of the lake's surface. So I just want to throw that out there because, from our view, that's one opportunity we have in the Great Lakes region to mitigate climate change. And I'll I guess I'll leave it there.
Good. Thanks, Emily. I think what you're seeing here is the interrelated issues and how it was mentioned earlier, and I think in one of the plenary addresses, about climate change amplifying issues that already exist or changing issues, whatever, you know, that the scientists have been studying all along. And so I guess I want to ask, before we turn questions over, I want to ask the panelists a question, but I kind of want to, just a show of hands here to turn this at this point. How many folks here cover Great Lakes issues, either as journalists or scientists? How many people here are from Great Lakes? Okay, so there's a lot. How many are not from Great Lakes? Okay, so there's more of us than them. I say that because I want to turn it in that way. The first question was going to be, if I saw a lot of hands that said you weren't from the Great Lakes area, to have these panelists explain, well, what does this matter? Is this a local issue? Okay, climate change affecting a local issue. Does this matter beyond our borders? Well, we can address that, but I don't think we need to as much with only a few here who aren't from the Great Lakes region. So then the question I would ask the panelists to respond to, and you all can, or maybe just one or two, whatever you're comfortable with, if with these the impacts of what we're discussing here. What are the impacts on the Great Lakes? In some sense, aren't we better positioned than them, the people who don't have the lakes on their doorstep? The problems that we're discussing, are we in bad shape? Are we in trouble? Are we better positioned even with the changes that are coming? You talked about the a moisture coming up from the Gulf. And I know that's true with Lake Erie. Lake Erie losing a lot of water, maybe in other ways. I'm speaking as a generalist and a journalist, but that the moisture may be masking some of the moisture coming up from the Gulf, maybe masking other water losses. And again, I say that as a generalist because I don't have the science that these fellows have. But so, are we well positioned, or are we in big trouble here? So put it down to the core.
Might start out with a very simple statement. We've lost homes. We've had people moving from flooding, and we've had sewage overflows. A lot of things that are not good news. But to address your question, if you had to accept the kind of climate changes that are occurring in Southern California and in Southern Spain versus the kind of changes we're experiencing, we're better off with more water and the increasing precipitation than we would have been if, in fact, the climate that we were experienced were the dramatic declines in rainfall and increase in aridity, loss of water supplies that are occurring both in Spain and Southern California. So in that sense, we're better off. And then I'm going to leave it with just one last comment. That doesn't mean we don't have problems to solve and adaptations for a sustainable life in this area, regardless of being better off.
Someone else want to take it as well, or no?
Well, I think there are different kinds of problems we have here than they have in Southern California or in Arctic Canada. But they're real problems to people living around the lakes and using the lakes to produce hydropower, for recreation, for drinking water. I think they're quite serious problems for many of the uses of the Great Lakes that we have come to love and accept.
Okay. And for those couple of folks, and I didn't mean to ignore you at all, for the folks who aren't from this area, why should they care about what's going on with the Great Lakes? What's the role of the Great Lakes in terms of our entire country?
Well, the economy in the Great Lakes has probably declined a bit in the last few years, but it's a major economic driver for the continent, and the people that drink water out of the Great Lakes number something like 30 million people. So it's a fairly significant chunk of the North American continent. It's really important to Canada.
We're actually, the Great Lakes region is the third largest economy in the world. And it's, you know, home to 45 million people, major economic and tourism, and just, you know, and quality of life here. I think, and the largest 20% of the world's fresh surface water is in the Great Lakes. So it's a resource worth protecting for all kinds of reasons.
Now, Emily, you had said, and we mentioned earlier the 2008 testimony that you had given, you had said in there something about that we have the tools to do what we need to do, but I don't know if you said we lacked the political will, but you were saying we need the political will. Tell everyone about that, about what needs to be done in terms of legislatively and things that need to happen as far as protecting the Great Lakes.
Well, I think, I mentioned the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which was one piece of the overall Great Lakes Restoration Strategy, and I think we need to move on that very quickly. We've been talking about how to protect and save the Great Lakes for years. We have a number of plans to do that. The time is now, because the longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to get and the harder these problems are going to be to solve. So we need the funding, and the House and Senate both have put money in their budgets for Great Lakes restoration, I think $475 million and $400 million respectively for this coming fiscal year. But that funding needs to continue year after year, and we also need some big policy changes. Invasive species are a huge threat to the region and are probably one of the biggest stressors to the ecosystem as a whole. And we now have Asian carp within a mile of the barrier and in the Des Plaines River in Chicago right next door. So, we need to solve that problem, and we need to get, solve the ballast water problem. Those are policy things. So that's just an example of on the adaptation side, some of the things that we need to do in terms of policy and funding to help protect the Great Lakes.
And I'd like to direct one more question before we take a question. That is, and maybe this will help those who are out there as well. Each of you, in a quick form, and maybe I'm doing this for selfish reasons as a reporter who covers the Great Lakes, but tell me one story that journalists, the one story that they're not getting to, or alternately, what is the most important story that they ought to be doing as we approach stories? There's a dizzying array of stories. We can do stories on algae, on invasive species, on ice cover, and all those things. What is maybe the story that we're not getting to, or alternately, what's the most important one? Go ahead, John. We'll pull the mic to you there.
I'll let somebody else take it.
All right, we'll start with that one. All right. No suggestions?
Well, my suggestion is that I think that we did a good job, the two countries, in the 70s and 80s under the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that was signed in 72, in cleaning up the lakes, and both from toxic chemicals point of view and from reducing the nutrient loading and the rate of eutrophication. But what we see now is a backsliding. And I think that climate change is one of the significant contributing factors to that backsliding. And I don't think that's been reported very much.
I will say on this, I wish the story that we're getting told a little bit more was the urgency of the situation and the urgency of the need to act. Again, I think we know basically what to do, and we know what some of these problems are, but whether it's invasives or, all of these problems, we have a window of time here in which we need to take action and need to take action now, and I'm not sure that the community as a whole understands the urgency of doing so. In part, too, to help prepare us for the coming impacts of climate change.
All right, we'll take questions from the audience. And just a reminder, they've asked me, this is in front of me, to remind that SEGM members ask questions first and later, and if there's time, we'll get to the others. So if you have an opportunity, give your question, and I'll repeat it. Go ahead.
One of the great features, of course, of the Great Lakes is that it's a great source of borders. You've got Canada, the United States, you've got provinces, and I'm thinking of the St. Lawrence River as well. You've got provinces, and you've got states, and of course, you've got municipalities. James, but I'm wondering if the others have comments as well, can talk about issues of international cooperation. And I'm thinking all levels of government, not just federal and state and group level, but for instance, at municipal level through something like the Great Lakes Saving on Cities Initiative.
I apologize, and I know we just worked together before the session. Go ahead.
Sorry, Saul Sharris, Toronto Freelance.
Okay, Toronto Freelance, Saul.
There
you go. And his question, most of you probably heard it, we're a small group right now, but the idea of what kind of international cooperation is going on, even at the local level. Is that right? Okay.
The best international cooperation occurs, I think, through the International Joint Commission, which has set up a system of cooperation between both the federal agencies, the state and provincial agencies, and there's a significant involvement of municipalities in that activity as well. They have done, I think, a pretty good job of pulling that together. The two senior governments, the federal governments, need to get their act together more effectively in the next little while. And I'm very much hoping that the idea of the major rehabilitation program that's being launched by the Obama administration in the United States slops over into Canada, and we see some new funding and renewed commitment to cleaning up our part of the problem.
We'll go to the we'll go right and then left.
Joe Shuchek, UW Madison. Maybe my question will also raise an answer to your question. And I think a story that's missing is the things we're going to do for adaptation versus mitigation. We hear a lot about cutting, reducing emissions, and so forth. But I think some of the recent studies show that perhaps we're already going to have changes occur no matter what we do for mitigation. So my question is if we have limited funds, where should our adaptation priorities be? Should they be in infrastructure? Where is the money best spent in order to adapt to the changes that we expect to see?
Joe's got a booming voice, so I imagine you heard that one too, but I have my instructions. His question, with limited funds, where should the money go in regards to adaptation? Where's our money best spent? That's a short version, Bill. Go ahead.
Well, I would argue that the first place is in infrastructure. And I don't know what you mean by infrastructure. I mean, infrastructure might be a highway, but I was thinking of infrastructure in terms of providing ways and means by which local communities, individual areas can begin to develop adaptation strategies to deal with the changes that are occurring under their feet. I think if you go to the IJC, they're talking adaptation at the international level. If you go to most state legislatures, I wonder if, in fact, or provincial legislatures, I wonder if you, in fact, have the idea of adaptation being addressed at the present time. And this is an issue where there are adaptations that need to occur in the metropolitan sewage districts, in the county boards, and things of that nature. And I would argue that our adaptation strategies on most of these groups where much of the adaptation will have to occur are not on the table yet. And so that's the kind of infrastructure that I was referring to. We have a fledgling example in Wisconsin with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts that I can talk more about, and it's in my handout. And you can Google it and see what's going on there. But I don't think many states are doing that yet. They're beginning to. And if you look at the agendas of the state agencies, the county boards, I think you are just beginning to see adaptation even coming onto the table.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I'm Dave Polson, Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. I kind of want to follow up on Saul's comment and quite a problem here in the sense that we're talking to the more science folks than the political folks, but maybe Emily, you could help us out with this. What are the politics of Canada? What are they going to pony up? We're talking about $500 million for a down payment first year over many, many other years. Is Canada sitting back and expecting us to clean all this up? Or is there any movement on foot that we'll get a bidding war going?
Dave's question is, what is Canada doing about this? I mean, are they going to pony up some money? Can we get some competitive bidding war going on and trying to take care of this issue? So someone want to take that one?
Well, I think that's a great question. I hope we can get a bidding war going. We're trying hard to on the Canadian side. And we see some signs that our present administration is interested in following the Obama administration in many ways. So we need to get them to follow their lead this way on the Great Lakes. I should say that there are existing long-term programs on cleanup of the Canadian side of the Great Lakes, and we have far fewer areas of concern which need special attention on the Canadian side than we do on the U.S. side, partly because of lower population. But there's no question it would be great if we could find some way of getting a greater commitment on the Canadian side to match the work that's been announced anyway on the U.S. side and that we've heard about from Cam Davis and others.
Okay. I guess I'll just add quickly that, you know, the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which is the binational agreement sort of between the two countries governing oversight of the Great Lakes, is up for renegotiation and review. And both federal administrations have committed to that. And so that's another opportunity, I think, to try to raise the bar across the board and promote that sort of a bidding war, which I'd love to see.
Yeah, any help you can give us in that direction by your articles would be very helpful.
And
thank you.
The only other thing I will say, you know, the window of opportunity I was talking about is not just ecological, it's sort of political, too. And that's, I think we, with the current administration in the U.S. and their interest in the Great Lakes and protecting the Great Lakes, that's as much of a reason as any for the urgency. I think we need to take full advantage of that.
Okay. Another question? Go ahead. The question is, for each of the panelists, is there one thing, one concern here, one great fear that rises to the top, one thing that would top the list and being the greatest concern? And he wants to hear each of you can boil it down, and that's kind of what we need sometimes.
I can start, or do you want to start?
I'll go ahead and start. I think I sort of indicated that my personal primary area is really seeming to be less of a concern than was previously thought as far as the changes in lake levels. I think what I'm really more concerned about now is to get an understanding of how climate change will affect Great Lakes temperatures and how it'll affect mixing of the nutrients and a shift in timing of that, which has great effects on the entire Great Lakes ecosystem. And it's also mixed in with what we would call multiple stressors, such as aquatic invasive species. So there are a lot of other things that are impacting the entire system that really get mixed up, and it's from a scientific standpoint, it's a really tough nut to crack, this entire system.
Every time I get a question, or we get a question, what's the most important thing that we must do? I'm always reminded, if you could give up one of these organs, which would you give up? Your heart, your lung, your brain, your bladder. And the thing's a system. And so in many ways, it's artificial. But having, and you have to deal with multiple things, or you're going to lose the battle. But if you look at the various things we expect in the Great Lakes region, which is maybe slightly drier summers, slightly wetter winters and springs and falls, increases in temperature, increase in temperatures above a certain temperature, above 90, decreases in temperatures below zero, and the increase in rain events of over 2 inches per day, for example. If you look at, go down the list and take health effects, natural resources, agriculture, lake level and water quality, rivers and streams, the thing that probably impacts all of those in a more serious and obvious way are extreme rain events. And so the extreme rain events are very perversive in terms of the parts of the system that they affect, and they affect it fairly recently. Another reason to consider the extreme rain events, I mean, it has an effect on health, it has an effect on flooding, lake levels, you name it. And the others do too, but somehow the extreme rain events are a little more dramatic. And I'm sure all of you have had stories like this. If you've read the paper the last couple of days, you will note that Gaze Mills is moving. Gaze Mills has had enough repeated flooding of their homes in the Kickapoo River that they've decided, and they've got the support to it, they're moving up on the hill a little bit, or up the slope a bit. Now, I would bet that the people in Gaze Mills do not know that one of the reasons they're moving is owing to climate change.
It's a climate change migration.
It's related to climate change. Now, none of us in the climate business would say that Gays Mill's flooding occurred because of climate change. We would never say that. But what we would say is the likelihood of those kinds of floods occurring in Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, even Ohio, are going to increase with climate change. Right. But there's so much spatial heterogeneity as to where the heaviest downpour occurs, and though that spatial heterogeneity is not picked up in the climate models. But I would think that agriculture in Wisconsin this year, we lost tremendous amount of farmland from flooding from rain. We have groundwater levels going up that are causing neighborhoods to be lost, not just overflows of streams. And I could go on with the liturgy. And the reason for picking these extreme rain events and the that part of it is partly because it affects so many of the impacts that are being felt in the Great Lakes, and also because it's one that the public is interested in and having to react to and don't understand very well.
And that spatial heterogeneity you referred to is really the concept of hit and miss, right? When you talk about the rains, the heavy rains that they're falling, so, you know, some places will get heavy, heavy rain, and nearby, just like you experience in any thunderstorm, right? You know, oh, wow, it's raining over at my neighbor's, or not neighbor, but, you know, someone a couple miles away, but not here, and they're seeing more and more of that, so that becomes an issue.
Well, that's true, and I've got a figure in the handouts that shows the distribution of rainfall during the storm that caused one of the dams to give out and wash houses away, and I'm sure it was on national and international TV. And a region is very likely, for example, if you live in this community or you live in Milwaukee, you are very likely to take the rain events that have occurred in Milwaukee and assume that that characterizes what's going to happen in Toronto, or you could do the same in southern Ontario. I mean, that what you have experienced in a 10-mile radius of in your weather station is what the future holds for you. If you look at that one chart, we had 14 inches of rain in one town, and 9 inches in another, 7 in another, and none in another. And as people plan for this, they have to increase the expected variance or the expected risk that they may occur. It's just as likely that that 14 inches could have fallen in Madison, or Milwaukee, or Janesville, and so forth. So I think people have not really adequately we haven't collectively communicated the degree of risk that we have from extreme rain events. And since they're rare, you know, we may not have another one for another 5 years, but that's life.
And I prodded John with a follow-up there without getting to the others for Jim and Emily to talk about your number one hit here for effects of climate change, or greatest fear, I think is how you framed it.
Well, I guess I would just agree with everything that John said, you know, both in terms of the analogy to your organs, I love that. yeah. Well, but that's why I chose to talk, in fact, about the, you know, the green infrastructure issue, flooding, extreme rain events, because it's an issue that affects communities, the quality of life, and the water quality in the Great Lakes, because sort of polluted runoff from cities and farm fields is one of the biggest sort of unaddressed problems that they think are contributing to the Lake Erie's dead zone recurring, you know, to coastal health issues. So it's a big, big issue for the region as a whole, for both the ecosystem and human communities, which is why I would put it pretty far up the list. And in fact, I failed to mention we are actually going to be releasing a slightly more detailed report on this on October 28th in a press teleconference. If anybody's interested, please come up afterwards. I'll give you the information, or make sure to send it to you. But we're going to have some mayors from the region talking about what they're doing and why, and that kind of thing. So,
okay. Other questions? We've got a few more minutes. We need to be out of here. Make sure we're out of here by noon. I have my orders there too.
Let me just wait.
I forgot you, didn't I, Jim? I thought we'd already done you.
No, I just wanted to make one point and to make common cause with Brent. I think that if the early projections of a big fall in Great Lakes levels were to come true, and we're trying to figure that out now, that would be a pretty catastrophic thing. It would severely impact the amount of hydropower we produce at Sault Ste. Marie, at Niagara Falls, on the St. Lawrence River between New York State and Ontario. It would severely impact Great Lakes shipping. It might, in fact, make Great Lakes shipping impossible, the large shipping, and would have enormous impact on ecosystems and coastal wetlands. So I think that is my biggest fear. It's assuaged a bit by the kind of studies that Brent's involved in and that the International Upper Great Lakes Study has been undertaking, because I think it's probably doesn't seem as imminent as it did before, but it would be a catastrophic event if it occurred.
Okay, last question, if anybody has one. I guess I want to ask one more, and that is, you know, I see two concurrent things here about research, trying to learn more, and also talking about trying to do more. These two things running concurrently, and that's maybe from the journalist point of view. Do you write stories about what are they studying, what are they learning about the Great Lakes, or do you write stories about what are they doing to fix it, or is it, you know, I guess to put it in the words of a former vice president who maybe stumbled through it, he says, you know, we know what we know, we know what we don't know. But what concerns us is that we don't know what we don't know, which sounded like circular logic, but I wonder about that. Are there still things, enough things, that we don't know what's going on with these large... A couple times it's been this idea of large system. The Laurentian Lakes are such a large system. Is there any chance that we're making any mistakes in what we're trying to do here because we don't yet know the answers? Mila.
Well... The policy person will take a crack at this. I mean, the scientists may not agree, but I think we've got a heck of a lot of things that I would call no regrets actions that are good things to do now, that will help improve quality of life and water quality in the Great Lakes Basin now, and will help us adapt to climate change. I think there's an awful lot we can do on both the mitigation and the adaptation side that we should do anyway. So, you know, our lack of knowledge to me is absolutely no reason not to act. We know plenty to act.
But yet, for one of the scientists, there's still plenty more to know, isn't there?
I would characterize it this way. I think that we know quite a lot about the impact of climate change on Great Lakes water quality. Mm-hmm. What we are quite uncertain about is what will happen to Great Lakes levels in a changing climate.
We are right at a few minutes before noon. Any other last follow-up questions or last statements that anybody wants to take away from this? Go ahead.
I'll make a last comment on adaptation. We have two ways we could move forward on this adaptation issue. One is to wait until it happens and just cope. In other words, do no planning at the international, national, state, province, local community level. And so if you get flooded out, you move. The other alternative is, if we want to have a sustainable future in terms of these changes that are occurring under our feet, that there's really a need for, at all levels of planning and governance, to step forward and start putting adaptation strategies on the table. And we've fought with these for years and haven't been proactive enough. And with the climate changing more rapidly, I think it's even more important that we don't wait and cope, but we get our local scientists, communities, decision makers, shakers and movers to begin to develop adaptation strategies. And you don't need to worry about whether the lakes go up or down. What you want to do then is you want to develop an adaptation strategy which has the robustness that you've got plans on the table for what to do given one alternative or the other. And I don't think our communities are developing adaptation strategies yet. They're beginning to.
Okay. Well said, and I'm reminded to have everyone, we're in the ballroom next, and they start at noon, so that's why we're running a few minutes beforehand. Thank you very much for coming, everybody, and thank you to the panelists.